Today is Friday, September 29th, 2023. This is part four of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Peter spells his last name H-U-N-T-O-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Okay, I'm good.
Great. Peter, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I just want to tell you again on tape here how much I really appreciated yesterday's oral history about pneumatists, of which I know absolutely nothing. really appreciated learning about that and your role in that, which is really fun. Let's carry on with your studies. Your master's thesis was on was geologic mapping of the Deer Creek to Peach Creek area, is that right?
That's right. And
How did that advance then after your master's was done?
Well, what we were dealing with were the largest karst springs coming out of caves in the central Grand Canyon area on the west side of the Kaibab Plateau.
Okay.
And that was a particularly interesting project. I was in the canyon itself. I was focused on the Pete's Amphitheater. And it looked like the next logical step would be to treat all the major karst springs that were in the Grand Canyon, all of which were on the north side of the Colorado River.
Okay.
And they drained the Kaibab Plateau.
Did you come up with that idea? It's like, well, gee, this was pretty fun. Let's just expand it.
Yeah, it was a natural. It was a natural evolution.
Okay.
And my thesis advisor, who was John Harshbarger, was very enthusiastic about doing the same thing because this was a major groundwater resource that had hardly been worked on anywhere.
Okay.
So he was real hot to go with it too.
Nice.
So what we did is we defined my PhD thesis as everything from Kanab Canyon over east to Vasey's Paradise and Marble Canyon.
Okay.
And that picked up a host of springs that were discharging from the Redwall Moab Aquifer near the bottom of the Grand Canyon on the north side.
Were you aware of the Fence Fault Spring? Did you encapture that as well, or was that because that's a spring that seems kind of like a little sleeper? It just sort of comes out right next to the river there.
And, yeah, that spring is on the south side, and of course we found it as soon as we started running the river and looking for these things.
Okay,
it's just upstream from Vasey's, about a half a mile or
yeah,
so.
Yeah,
and. But now, obviously, that thing fit into the big picture. But at the time, I was concentrating on the stuff that was coming out from the north.
Okay.
So Vasey's was kind of a later discovery that turned out to be quite significant. But, yeah, that kind of waited a few years.
Okay, the fence fault. Doesn't it come out like, isn't there a fault there that goes across the river, and doesn't it like come out at a multiple different springs there?
Yeah, the most of the water comes out on the south side.
Yes, okay.
But the fault goes across the river, and water goes underneath the river and comes up. Actually, the water that comes out at Fence Spring originates on the Kaibab Plateau, goes along the Fence Fault underneath the river, and bubbles up on the south side of the river.
Well, how cool is that?
Huh. Yeah, that's really dynamite finding.
Oh, very fun.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So when was your first river trip then?
Well, let's see. I got a river trip. I had two early on. One was with the National Park Service. They had a patrol boat that went down there. And a guy named Cross used to run that thing. And I got a ride on that when I was, I'm trying to think when that was. That would have been when I was first starting my PhD research. That would have been about 68 or something like that.
Okay.
And we ran all the way down to Pierce Ferry.
Okay.
And then...
What do you remember about that first trip? Let's start here, because you're in order to do your field work to see where these springs are coming into the Colorado River. I would assume you need to do a river trip to start looking for water.
Well, yeah, that certainly helped. The big problem with the river trips is that often the springs are way up the canyons from the river, so it's usually easier to reach them by hiking in from the rim.
Okay.
But anyway, this allowed me to get the overview.
Hmm.
Now, the thing that we were doing, of course, is we were correlating the occurrence of these springs with fracture zones that caves were developed along, and of course, they go across the river.
Right.
So I was interested in everything from the river all the way back to the state line up in Utah.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, this was like driving US 89, except you're on the water.
Right. Yeah.
And, so the river was a very valuable thing for me to see. So okay. I got this river trip down there. The next year, the Park Service arranged for me to tag along on a Tour West river trip that they were running. So I got a second trip on that.
Okay. And Tour West has an interesting boat configuration. Their side tubes are not pointed on the front, and they kind of hold them with big straps up out of the water.
That's a unique design to them.
Yeah, yeah. What do you remember about that river trip?
Well, yeah, he asked me about the park trip and also the Tour West. I'll tell you a little anecdote about both.
Great.
Probably the most memorable thing about the park trip was that we were using J-rigs on that, five tubes lashed together, and which was I thought it was a terrific boat. They could really handle bad rapids.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, one day we were down in the middle of the canyon, and I was real enthusiastic. I used to love to sit on the front of those J-rig tubes and get the full force of the rapids. And this one afternoon, I went running up there to get on the tube as we went into a rapid, and the darn thing was soft.
Oh.
And and I just fell right off the front of the boat.
Oh, my gosh.
And, I got run over by the boat. And I was very lucky. I used to wear a hard hat because I would always lose soft hats. So I had this hard hat on, and I went under the boat, and I could hear, people on the boat yelling that, I'd gone off the boat. And fortunately, the boatman turned the motor off.
Hmm.
I went right through the motor well. And that hard hat went right through the propellers on the engine.
Wow.
And left a couple of nice scratches, and I popped out the back. It was actually a good experience, because what I realized then was that, you could fall in the river, and if you had a life jacket on, you were going to live. So I started thinking about, one of these days I probably ought to get a couple of boats and do this myself.
Huh.
But anyway, that was a kind of an interesting experience, to
and
say the least.
I think that there was a fellow who was the head ranger. The park just started doing patrol trips then. His name was Glade Ross.
Yeah, that was the guy that ran the boat.
Okay.
Did I get the wrong name on that?
Well, no,
Glade.
I just want to double check. And he had a nickname. He was called Hardtack, but he wouldn't necessarily let people know that was his nickname. What do you remember about him?
Well, what I remember about him was he was an extremely competent guy, and he knew every rock in the river.
Okay.
And of course, as a newbie, that really impressed me that anybody knew something with that detail.
Yeah.
And he was also a very conscientious guy, and he was really easy to work with for me. Of course, I was just a newbie passenger at
mm-hmm.
that point in my career, but I really appreciated those aspects. But that's about what I remember. The last time I saw him was at the Gates of Lodore. He was He was up there working for the Park Service, and I happened to run into him when I was running a trip down through Lodore.
That's right. That's exactly right. He worked for Dinosaur up there for quite a while.
Yeah, he was highly respected.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
Now, as far as the Tour West thing, I had a really unique opportunity with them because about two-thirds or three-quarters of the people that were on the boat were all Tour West family members. They
were
running a trip for themselves. And so I got in on that. And they had everybody from their grandmothers down to their kids. And, you know, this was great. And I had a really good time on that trip. But probably the most memorable thing about that trip was the ride home. We got out at Pierce Ferry. They had a big box truck that they put these couple of boats in. And this thing had about a foot and a half of air space above the rubber and the ceiling of the thing.
Okay.
And they put two-thirds of the family up there in that thing, you know, like, you know, there's like 10 people up there. And, you know, there's hardly any room to breathe. And we left Pierce Ferry late in the afternoon, so we were going through Las Vegas just as it was starting to get dark. And we had to, we were going up to St. George, and they were going on to Kanab.
Okay.
That was before they'd built the freeway through the Virgin River Canyon.
Right.
So we had to go over the range there, the Virgin Mountains. And that truck was heavy, and we were hauling a trailer.
Oh, wow.
And one of the, there was a young boatman who was a family member. He and I, we couldn't stand a claustrophobic truck, so we stepped out on the back, and we were standing on the tongue of the trailer and riding the trailer, the tongue up the highway. When we got to that hill going over the Virgin Range, that truck slowed down to 5 miles an hour.
Oh, my gosh.
And we're sitting there, and I'm thinking, whoa, this thing is going 5 miles an hour. It's going to take us 3 hours to just make the hill. And that's exactly what it took.
We didn't
get off the hill until the morning. Yeah, that was kind of it was hot, and we were out there hanging on to the back of the truck riding that thing over. That was pretty funny.
My gosh. Huh.
But anyway, yeah, that was a real nice opportunity for me to, you know, see the canyon again from the interior.
From the river then.
Yeah, and of course those people were very nice to me. They were, it was a real nice trip.
Nice. Very nice. And so when did you start hiking in then from the rim to try to get to these springs? Of course, Roaring Springs would have been easy there on the North Kaibab Trail. But there's some other springs that are a little more difficult to get to.
Well, that was, I started working on the field part of that project in, that would have been 69 and 70.
Okay.
And, actually 68 and 70. I'd go up there in the summers. And, I had field assistants that went with me.
Who was that?
And, the guy that worked with me on my PhD thesis was a fellow named Tom Beathard. And Tom and I would hike off the North Rim on any route we could find into the canyons that had springs.
Okay.
So we were often very rarely using trails. We were just going down fault zones or whatever we could get through to get down to the bottom.
Okay.
And that took all summer.
Did you get any trail advice from like Harvey Butchert or some of the other Grand Canyon hikers, or were you just like, well, let's figure it out?
Well, we were doing it on our own.
Okay.
I did talk to Harvey on occasion, and I talked to other people that had been down there, and some people knew routes. Typically we were kind of pioneering routes, at least, you know, we didn't have guides or anything like that, written or verbal. We just looked around until we saw places that looked like we could get down and went down.
Yeah. How do you spell Tom's last name?
Beathard, B-E-T-H-A-R-D.
Thank you. Okay, great. And I'm trying to think sort of quickly as I'm pondering this. Well, let's see. There was water in Nankoweap, so you would have wanted to find the source for that water. And there's some water in Quoggint, but not a whole lot. A little water in Unkar. Were you actually going for little water sources, or were you looking for sort of the Clear Creek, Java Falls type water sources?
Yeah, I was looking for the big stuff. We bypassed okay. that little stuff. Well, there was one up in Nankoweap that we went to that was a particularly challenging area to get into.
Okay.
We came down the Nankoweap Trail to the top of the Supai, and then we got ledged out on the top of the Supai.
Okay.
So we came back a couple of days later and looked around, and there was a fault zone that went down into upper Nankoweap that we spotted.
Okay.
And that was a real hump from the top of the Supai down to the top of the Red Wall, and we went down this fault zone. And we came out way up in Nankoweap. And we kind of wondered if we weren't pioneering a route, because this thing had never been used, and it was kind of difficult. But it got us all the way down there, and subsequently that's been a shortcut that a lot of people use to get into upper Nankoweap.
That's right.
But one thing that was interesting about it, once we got in the bottom, the spring I was looking for was still up the canyon a mile or two.
Okay.
So we had to hike up there. And as we were hiking up there, we went over a little, a junction between two side canyons, the flat area there.
Yep.
As we were crossing this flat area, we noticed it was kind of littered. So we started looking around, and there was glass and stuff like that. And one of the interesting things we found was one of those medicine bottles that's about 4 inches long that has a long tube on it.
Oh, wow.
Instead of a cap and all that.
Uh-huh.
And we realized, hey, this is an old thing. And Bethard went over to a wall and found some etchings on the rock. And it looked like what we'd stumbled onto was one of C.D. Walcott's camps.
Oh, wow.
When he was in there in 1890.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a real kick. And what I recall was there was this wall that had a nice desert varnish on it, and somebody had carved a picture of a geologist with a pith helmet on.
Oh, wow.
Taking a leak.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, huh? It was. That's probably still there. Yeah, that was a good one.
Very neat.
But some of the trips we got in there were pretty good. Another memorable one was we went down into Shinumu one time, and we came off of north rim at Muav Saddle.
Okay.
Took the Muav Saddle Trail down to Shinumu Creek, and then we hiked up into Shinumu Amphitheater. And we were down there for about a little less than a week.
Okay.
Now, one of my colleagues had told me that one of these caver colleagues, a guy named Art Lang, had told me about a route that he'd gotten down into the Supai, into Upper Nankoweap. So I knew about this route that he'd taken that went out, and that was worth knowing. And he'd gotten down to the top of the Red Wall on this particular thing.
Okay.
Well, anyway, Bethard and I went up the canyon. We did all the forks. We got into a couple of big springs and some caves up there.
So that's Merlin's and Modred's abysses?
Yeah, Merlin and Modred and all
that. And there are some big caves in there.
Yeah, there's some big springs.
Yeah.
So we were really onto that. Well, anyway, what happened was one night we went up to one particular big spring, which came out of the Muav, of course. All that stuff is way down there low. And we got there just at dusk, and it looked pretty good. And we were clambering over boulders to get to this thing. And as we looked up the canyon, we saw that there was a route right out to the top of the Red Wall. It just looked like it went all the way.
Huh.
So we were, and the head of that canyon was the one that Lang had told me he'd gotten down to the top of the Red Wall on.
Okay.
So I realized, hey, this is a through trip. We don't have to go all the way back around and up the trail through Muav Saddle.
Right.
So what we did was the classic thing you do. we sat down and had a big feast and ate all the food and just kept enough for breakfast and realized we were home free. Well, the next morning we got up, packed up our stuff, and started hiking up this ramp. And, of course, it turned flat on us, and we were looking at a 150-foot cliff at the end of the rip wall to get through.
Oops.
And I'm sitting there saying, holy smokes, don't have enough food to get out the trail. This is going to be a real experience. So Tom and I started picking around there. Well, it turned out there was some spire at the end of the canyon that was peeling off the red wall.
Huh.
And we were able to climb up halfway through that. So now we were 75 feet up this thing, and we had 75 feet to go. And we managed the next 50 feet or so. We got to a place where we could step onto a ledge at the top of the red wall. We were only about 15 feet from the
very close.
Home free.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm feeling pretty good, but real anxious because this thing is cliffed out on us. And we had this ledge, followed this ledge towards the head of the canyon, and it looked like it was going to make it to the head and we would be able to walk out. Well, of course, we got about 30 feet along this thing, and the part of the ledge had dropped off, and
Oops.
It was, you know, 200 feet to the bottom. So there we were, hung about 15 feet below the top of the red wall in this stupid ledge, you know. And finally, I don't remember how we did it, but one of us climbed on the other guy and got up to the top and pulled the other guy up, and then we knew we were home free, and we were out by 10 o'clock, you know. It was
wow.
One of those things. And that was one of the more challenging experiences. Another tough place to get into was Crystal Canyon.
Okay.
Now, you have to understand it. We're now in there, and this is 1968 or 69, probably 69. That was just a couple of years after the great flood that created Crystal Rapids.
Oh, right.
So what we came in from the north rim. We clambered down and made our way into the upper end of Clear Creek Canyon.
Okay.
And then we hiked out to the river, and, of course, we saw the rapid and all that. But the beauty of this is that the rapid was created by terrific mud flows that just swept out everything in Clear Creek Canyon.
Right.
So once we got down to the level of the Muave, it was just it was like walking down a highway. It was absolutely amazing. We'd walk down there. There wasn't a cottonwood tree left in the place. There was nothing. There was just water going down a clean, scoured canyon. And
all the way down to bedrock.
All the way down to bedrock.
Wow.
And all that junk was out in the river and gone. And once in a while, we'd go by a stump of a cottonwood tree.
Huh.
It would be sticking out. It would be about 2 or 3 feet high. That looks like a pile driver had been working on the top of it.
I bet.
But it was just easy going. It was nice.
Wow.
Yeah, sometimes you look out.
Hey, Pete, can you tell me what you remember about Art Lang?
Well, Art was a guy who was very interested in caving, and he got in a Grand Canyon in the early 60s, I suppose.
In the 50s, didn't he do a river trip, a speleological river trip?
Yeah, he would have done that. It was the 50s and 60s when he was in there.
Okay.
He had a partner named Ray Desasseur.
Yes.
And the two of them worked together. Art was... He had made some real contributions. He found caves with the split twig figurines in them.
Right.
And wrote an article on that. And one of his articles was published in Plateau. I remember that.
Okay.
But anyway, Plateau is the publication of the museum in Northern Arizona.
Right.
But anyway, Art had kind of organized this thing called the Cave Research Associates. It was just him and Desasseur.
Okay.
But anyway, they used that moniker. And they had a little publication. It was a 3 or 4 page publication called Cave Notes that they'd put out. And some of this Grand Canyon work ended up in that Cave Notes thing. But anyway, Art was, when I met him, he was my senior. He was a little older than me.
Okay.
And he had a friend named Tom Ailey, who was a graduate student at the University of Arizona in the hydrology program before I got there.
Okay.
And Ailey was a cave explorer. And those guys had been doing the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
So anyway, I got on a couple of trips with them. And the most interesting trip that we did was one time we went after Chiava Falls, because this was before I was doing my thesis.
Okay.
But what we did is we drove up to the Wahala Plateau, got above the cave, and then we descended the canyon straight down to the top of the Red Wall and roped over the Red Wall down to the spring. Chiava Falls comes out of a cave that's 250 feet below the top of the Red Wall, so you gotta come down 250 feet to get to the base of the spring, and then you can walk into the cave and see it from there.
Okay.
And that was a particularly exciting trip. What we other people had been in there, and so this thing was kind of, the route was known.
Okay.
And what we did is we started at the top of the Kaibab, made our way down to the top of the Coconino, and we hit our first cliff, which was about 80 feet.
Okay.
And, of course, we had equipment. We had cable ladders, and we were that I'd made, and we were using that stuff. So we were looking at this cliff. It was 80 feet high, and let's see. I got to think. The Cole brothers had gone down there,
right?
And they wrote an article about this thing. So we were following their route. Well, you know, when you're following people's routes, you've read what they've said, and you get to see if they, you know, if they're exaggerating. And one thing I can tell you about the Cole brothers was, at least for this particular thing, everything they wrote was absolutely accurate.
Oh, cool.
For example, they described this drop off the Coconino, which was 80 feet, and they said there was a pine tree out in front, and what they'd done is they'd somehow, they'd roped over to the pine tree and climbed down the pine tree, and they said that thing was 80 feet high. Well, they were right, and they said it was out there 15 or 20 feet from the ledge.
Oh, wow.
That was good to an inch. It was good. Anyway, we dropped through that, and that was no problem.
Okay.
And we dropped on down. There was a bunch of ledges in the Supai that we had to get over.
Okay.
And there had been a another party that had gone in there. It was some European climber.
Yes, with a guy named Dale Slocum, a photographer out of Phoenix.
Yeah, yeah. The two of them had gone down there.
Yeah.
Well, what we were following was the routes of both the Cole brothers and the climber.
Okay.
And when we got down into the Supai ledges, we started finding the debris from these two guys, two trips. And the latter group, the climber and the other fellow, they had taken down a spool of gold line.
Oh, wow.
And of all things, the spool was laying in the canyon. They'd rolled the spool down the canyon
gosh.
With the rope on it, you know. And we'd find pieces of the rope over the ledges and stuff like that.
Huh.
And there was one ledge in the Supai that was about, I don't know, it was about 20, 25 feet high. And I got below this thing, and I was looking for some water. There was no water on the route. Mm. But anyway, I got below this thing, and I had to get back up. And so I did the thing you do. I was walking the base of this ledge until I found a break. Well, anyway, what happened was I was going along the ledge, and here was a little pine tree that grew almost to the top of the ledge.
Okay.
And that's a good ticket up. So I climbed up this pine tree, and as I was climbing it, and I got towards the top, I realized there's something the matter with this tree. And what I ran into was the top of it was all mashed down, and the branches were growing screwy on it. And it was very clear that something had landed on top of this tree.
Oh, wow.
And so I got up on that mess, and I was able to reach the top of the ledge, and I was feeling around, and I grabbed onto a chunk of wire.
Huh.
And I'm thinking, what's going on? So I pulled myself up on the wire, and I made it over the ledge. Well, what I'd found was a tree that the Cole brothers had climbed, and they'd used this wire to get over the edge.
Oh, wow.
Still there.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff really tickles you when you're, you know, this is, what is that, 50,
yeah.
75 years later,
That's right? That's right.
So anyway, once we got down to the top of the red wall, we got ourselves positioned right over the Shiava Spring. we were going to set cable ladder down there. I had 250 feet of cable ladder left, and we were going to use that to get down to the bottom.
Okay.
And what we ran into was a real mess at the top of the cliff. There was a mast built out over the canyon made out of logs that were wired together. And then the boom that stuck out over the canyon had a place to hook a pulley. And besides that, somebody had dropped a wire that they'd tied around the end of this boom all the way down to the Shiava Falls.
Oh, wow.
So you had 250 feet of this wire going down there and this boom, and all this junk was in the way.
Huh.
And what this was the apparatus that the Cole brothers had made to go into the cave. And when you read their report, they don't describe this thing, but they do tell you that they had a pulley set up there. One brother was lowering the other brother on the pulley, and clearly what they were doing is they put the wire down there so that he had something to hold on to so he wouldn't spin.
Got it.
So that was the deal. Well, anyway, in the report, what happened was the one brother was halfway down, and a big thunderstorm came over, and it started lightning like hell.
Get this wire. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that. You know, we're seeing a wire. Now, they didn't mention that in their article, but I'm looking at that wire, and I'm thinking whoever's on that rope is going to be really fried down there.
No kidding.
Well, anyway, the one brother was hanging there. He was about halfway down. Here comes the storm. The brother on the top said, no deal. He went over and tied him off to a tree, and he got under a rock and waited till the storm went by. Then he came back and he lowered his brother down. So anyway, that's the way they got in there. What we found also up there was a string of carabiners and chunks of gold line that the second crew had left behind.
Okay.
And we had our equipment and went down there.
Okay.
Now, the funny thing on that was, you know, you talk about memories. This is trivia, but this is the kind of thing you remember.
Mm.
I was using old equipment, and one thing I had done is I brought an extra pair of boots that were my brother's, and he had been in the Army.
Okay.
And so I had these old Army boots, and I was going to use them to slog through the water in the Vases Cave. And we got down there, and I went to put those boots on. I shoved my foot in there, and, man, I creamed my toes. I look in there, and what I'd carried down in a canyon was a set of metal the things you're sticking a shoe to keep the shape.
Oh, like a shoehorn.
Shoehorns, yeah. And I'd carried those heavy things all the way down there. I couldn't believe it. So, you know, of course I pull them out, you know. It's one of those funny things that you do.
Oh, my gosh.
And not being the most environmentally conscious guy, I left those shoe trees at the entrance of the cave.
Now you're really going to confuse somebody. What the heck were these things
for? Who would have shoe trees down in the Grand Canyon?
Yeah.
Well, I subsequently learned that a subsequent party discovered those, and they wondered just what the heck had happened down
there. I bet.
One thing the Cole brothers did is they ran into a 15-foot or 20-foot high ledge inside the cave that they had to get over.
Okay.
And they must have gone back to the top. But anyway, what they did is they hauled in some 2x4s.
Oh, wow.
And they had these 2x4s, they built a ladder out of them.
Okay.
And they got these straps that have holes in them that hold pipes in a basement.
Oh, like a metal plumber strap.
Yeah. What they did is they used those for the rungs, And they ran wire up the two sides, and they nailed these things onto the 2x4s, and they made this ladder that went up over this ledge. Well, that ladder had been there for, I don't know, what, 50, 60 years, something like that, more, probably more. And that was the only ticket up there. So I tried it, and they held, and I was able to climb up using their old ladder.
Nice.
It, that was, you know, you were wanting, this thing was in the water, and it was in awful shape, but it worked.
Okay.
But anyway, it was a real kick to find all that stuff from those guys.
I bet.
Both of those trips. Now, the people that went in there with the gold line,
okay,
they rappelled down to the cave. They pulled their ropes in after them, and then once they were at the cave, they rappelled the 750 feet down to the bottom of the canyon, and they hiked out through Phantom Ranch.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's how they got out of there.
All right.
The Cole brothers went back up the way they came.
Got it. What did you do? You went back up your ladder? Uh-huh. And how big is that cave?
Well, it goes in about, you know, maybe a quarter of a mile.
Okay.
And we didn't get all the way to the back, but the last half of it is just this horrible mud hole.
Ah.
And it's small, promising.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, there's a fellow who's been in there, a guy named Jason Belinsky. He's the current guru on caving in the Grand Canyon, and he's pushed that as far as anybody's going to go.
Cool.
But it just, there was no information beyond where I turned around, so we got out of there.
I'm going to ask you about Art Lang's friend, Raymond Desachure. Did you ever meet Ray?
Oh, yeah, I know him.
What did you remember about Ray?
Well, he was a gung-ho hiker and a caver.
Okay.
And they were from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And the only thing I remember about Ray that was outstanding was he liked to talk about these mountaineering trips he took.
Ah.
And he had the unfortunate experience of having two back-to-back weekend trips where he went out on these trips and had somebody get killed on both of them.
Oh, my gosh.
Where, you know, they slipped on snow and went flying down the coals until they hit the rocks. But anyway, yeah, that was kind of sad.
Yeah.
I didn't know Ray real well. And,
okay.
He died after you know, 8 or 10 years after I met him.
Okay. Yeah, because these guys were sort of the cavers, Grand Canyon cavers, before you were in there. Like I say, they were in there in the 50s and the 60s trying to do some caving, and so it's kind of interesting just looking at the history of caving in the canyon, and they get their day in the sun in there.
Yeah, they had primarily been working with the stuff that was at the top of the Red Wall.
Okay.
And this turned out to be a paleo karst. That is a karst that was developed on top of the Red Wall limestone before the supai was deposited.
Got it.
And a lot of those caves are very short. And so most of the caves that they worked were these short little things. Now, they were ideal for the Native Americans to be using, and that's why they found these split-twig figurines.
Got it.
But as far as getting in real deep, they didn't see very much.
Okay.
They did discover Silent River Cave, which had a couple of miles of passageway in it. That was at the top of the Red Wall.
Huh.
But neither one of them was interested in the big stream caves that we were after down in the bottom of the canyon.
Okay.
So I got to see, in terms of thrilling caves, some what I considered to be more dynamic caves and longer than they did.
Okay.
And then Belinsky has found stuff in both the top of the Red Wall and below that makes the stuff we found look like nothing. But anyway,
right.
That's the way it goes.
Yeah. Did you get into Vases?
Yeah, I got into Vases, but not very far.
Okay. All right.
That thing was the problem with Vases was is the climb up to it is terrible. And,
right.
And once you're in it, the passage is kind of small, and I didn't get very far in that.
Okay. Yeah, Donald Davis had talked about going quite a ways in there.
Yeah. Yeah, Belinsky's been in there 2 or 3 miles.
Yeah, it's amazingly long that way. But you just got to make sure it's not raining. Because
yeah, that thing floods. And what was interesting was there's three entrances, and the water comes out the water usually comes out the upper entrance, the upstream entrance, and then when it floods, the water comes out the middle entrance. And during the 70s, a flood came through there, and apparently a rock came rolling down with the water, and it largely blocked up the upper entrance. So the one on the upstream side got blocked off, and most of the water started coming out the middle entrance. Well, if the water's coming out the middle entrance, then the passage sumps just behind that, so you can't get in there. And so from the 70s until the last couple of years, that thing had been inaccessible because you just couldn't get into it.
Oh, wow.
One of the boatmen, and you'll know him, I don't know, one of them's a real hot climber, he knew about people getting into the cave, and he started climbing up the waterfall that went to the middle entrance, and he moved off to the downstream side and ended up going in the dry third entrance, which is a hairy, hairy climb. I don't know how the guy ever got in there, but he did it. So there's been other people that have been fooling around with a place.
Yeah.
I've been in there when the flood started coming through, and then all of a sudden the water's coming up, and all the joints along the side of the canyon start squirting water and all this kind of stuff. It's pretty dynamic. Very dangerous place.
How quickly can you retreat is the question.
Yeah, well, you know, what if you're in there and you've spent a day and a half getting to the back of the cave and you got to get out in 2 hours, you're not going to make it.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so I'm sort of thinking that you guys got in Inkwheat, you got in Chiawa Falls, Clear Creek, and got in the Dragon Crystal Corridor there, and then Shinumu. And
all
to the Pete's.
Stuff in Bright Angel Canyon and Phantom Spring up above Phantom Ranch. That's a big spring.
All right.
Yeah, and we saw them all, you know.
Nice.
But most of that, you know, the only way we could get at it was hiking. You couldn't get, if you did it from the river trips, that was just too miserable.
Mm. And then as you're hiking in off the rim, were you, thinking about sort of the geological map or even the hydrological map of the place, how are you looking at that landscape, thinking about hydrology?
Well, what I was doing was mapping the faults. So that meant we were walking the rims, finding the faults, and tracing them back onto the plateau.
Oh.
And then when we were tracing them back onto the plateau, we had terrific opportunities to use aerial photography to extend them. And we were mapping all the way from the canyon rim all the way up to the Utah state line and beyond. So, we were looking at a huge amount of territory.
I mean, some of those faults are really massive. I was thinking the Bright Angel Fault goes up on the north rim, but then drops right down into the canyon again and crosses Marble Canyon, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of does that. What you have is the Eminence Break.
Okay.
It's a big fault that's on the marble platform on the south side of the river. And that is kind of the extension of the Bright Angel Fault.
Okay.
But the two, if you can imagine these two lines starting to approach each other, as they get close to each other, they bend away from each other.
Oh, wow.
And that's what happens with the Bright Angel Fault. The Bright Angel Fault goes up Bright Angel Canyon, and then it makes a gentle turn to the north, and the Eminence Fault comes down from the northeast and makes a gentle turn to the southeast.
Do you have an explanation for that? Do you have some thoughts on why that would happen?
Is it just
the nature of the rock? Or?
Well, what it is that probably in the basement it's one fault, but as it got reactivated, the East Skybab monocline goes between the two and interrupts them. So you got a structural roll there that deflects the deformation.
Okay.
Yeah, it's wild.
That makes sense.
I've written an article about that.
Cool. Okay. And so in your PhD, were there any classes that you were taking at the U of A that you remember that were really interesting or inspiring?
Well, yeah, well, you're talking about 2 years of coursework. There was great stuff there.
Mm.
And one thing that I got into was we started making digital models of these groundwater systems. This is what you're doing is solving differential equations that describe the groundwater flow through rocks. And I used some of that for my thesis.
Okay.
And there was a young prof down there at the U of A named Jack Sturgill, who was very, very interested in this digital modeling stuff. And so he and I worked together to understand the process. So that was a great learning experience. And that stuff I used later in my professional career when I got to Nebraska. I did 4 years of that digital modeling stuff out there.
So I'm thinking of punch cards.
Yeah, it was all on punch cards, and the programs I was writing were, 1,000 or 2,000 punch cards. And if you got, you make one typo, you wasted another 4 hours.
yeah, just to run the thing, just to run the program to see what happened.
Yeah, that's right. Huh. There was another guy down there that was very important to me. His name was Evans B. Mayo. And he was an old structural geologist who did a thesis in the Sierra Nevadas back in the back in the 20s or 30s.
Okay.
And so when I got to him, he was just about retired. But one of the things that Evans was really interested in were features called breccia pipes.
Okay.
Or he was also interested in diatremes.
Okay.
Now these are pipe-like structures that come up through the sedimentary section, and you get to see them. Well, anyway, he was talking about this stuff in the classes, and, I was thinking, well, this is real exotic, and, I never have to worry about that kind of stuff. Well, lo and behold, when we get up in the Grand Canyon, we're running into breccia pipes all over the place, and some of these are uranium-bearing,
yeah,
and they're the big uranium mines on the south rim area,
right,
and also on the north rim, and we started putting them on the maps, and as we were mapping the Eastern Grand Canyon quad, Billingsley found one of these things up in Kanab Canyon. And there was a mine up there that was in one of these pipes. And he noticed that there was a pipe right next to the one they'd been mining and put it on the map and thought nothing of it.
Huh.
The map got published. They buy the map for $5. And these guys found a multi-million-dollar uranium load
right next to them. Wow!
Yeah, right next to them.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, that's the Canyon Mine or whatever it is up there.
Huh?
Yeah, that was funny. Yeah, too bad.
Wow!
They didn't put a claim on it. Yeah.
Huh? Remind me what a diatreme is.
Well, a diatreme is looks like the pipe that a volcano is creating as the magma is moving up through.
Okay.
But the problem is, usually these diatremes don't have magma in them. They have the broken up rock that's above and below the area that is being stoked.
Okay.
And it's a very peculiar thing. What you find is you find one of these things, and when you start looking at the rocks that comprise the diatreme, they're from both above and below the stratigraphic level you're in.
Oh, wow.
So that what you realize is that whatever fluids or whatever gases are creating these things, there's a circulation within them, and some material is moving up while other material is moving down.
That's crazy.
It's really strange.
Huh.
Now, a breccia pipe is a much simpler structure. What that is it's a collapsed structure into an existing cave.
Right.
So all the material is moving down. They're very distinctive. But in the Grand Canyon, these breccia pipes are phenomenal because some of them start at the bottom of the Muav and go all the way up to the top of the Kaibab.
Whoa.
We're talking about 2,000 to 3,000 feet high. And going beyond, actually, they have rocks that are younger than the Kaibab in them, which means that they were formed before those rocks were stripped away from the plateau.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, these breccia pipes are pretty common. They're particularly common in the Western Grand Canyon. And the interesting feature about them is, in order to be able to let this collapse stope its way up through the section, you have to continually create space for the rock to fall into, which means in these limestone terrains, which we have in the Red Wall and the Moab, as the pipe is forming, the groundwater circulation below it is dissolving away this debris, and it allows the pipe to continue to stope all the way up.
Oh, interesting.
Huh? The most famous of these is the uranium mine on the South Rim, the Orphan Pipe. You've heard of that.
Yes, yeah.
And that thing is about 2,000, 2,500 feet high. And they've mined it all the way from the surface down into the middle of the supai.
Mm.
So you got this shaft that's about 2,000 feet deep.
Yeah.
And, you know, several tens of feet in diameter.
Sort of a huge glory hole.
Yeah, and one of our mapping colleagues, the guy that did the Precambrian around the Eastern Grand Canyon, he did the Precambrian sedimentary rocks, was named Jim Sears. One time, Jim Sears and one of his buddies decided to go to the Orphan Pipe and take a look at it. What they did is they went down the Kaibab Trail or one of those trails.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Went down a trail. And they contoured along the supai until they got to the adit that went into the bottom of this pipe.
Right.
They went into the adit, and they found a little lake back there, a few inches or a couple of feet deep, that was the bottom of the pipe. And there was this wooden scaffolding that went all the way up to the top.
Whoa.
1,000 feet.
Wow.
And this is... made out of wood with, it's about 8 or 10 feet from one landing to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes all the way up. And these guys, they just started climbing this thing for the hell of it. Well, it was in pretty good shape. They only found a few places where their rungs were knocked out.
Okay.
And so they started climbing. Well, pretty soon they're pretty committed to this climb. And after a few hours... they're getting close to the top, and of course the anxiety is, will they get to the top, and is the gate locked, you know?
Yeah, or the last couple ladders are missing. I mean, yeah. Any number of things.
Well, you know, this is back in the late 50s, I guess, early
okay.
60s.
All right.
And finally, they popped out at the top, and boy, did they breathe a sigh of relief.
Wow.
The thing didn't have a lock on it, and they walked away.
How about
I
that?
Never heard of anybody else doing anything like that down there.
Huh.
Yeah, that was Jim Sears.
What do you remember about Jim?
Jim? Well, Jim was a guy that was a couple of years younger than me, and he was a student at NAU,
okay.
And then when he got his bachelor's degree, he transferred up to the University of Wyoming.
Okay.
And he was a graduate student up there, and he was one of the most gifted geologic field mappers I've ever known in my life.
Wow.
That guy could really do a job. And when he was at the University of Wyoming, he chose the Bright Angel area in the Grand Canyon as his master's thesis area.
Hmm. Okay.
And he went down there and mapped that Bright Angel Fault through the corridor. And nobody's ever done a better job on that than he did. So he was at Wyoming, and he was a good friend of George Billingsley. They were hiking partners when George was at the NAU.
Okay.
Jim Sears and he and their future wives were doing everything down there.
Okay.
So I knew of these guys.
Hmm.
Well, I was at the University of Nebraska, and about 1973 or 4, I went over to the University of Wyoming to visit Jim Sears. I just wanted to go visit him. And so I knew him. And when I got there, I started talking to him. And then I started talking to the chairman of the department. You know, we were just having a little conversation. And that led to a job over there, which was really good.
Oh,
so,
wow.
But anyway, once I got to Wyoming, Jim was finishing up his thesis, And he actually worked for me doing mapping up in the Bighorn Basin and the Bighorn Range of Wyoming. And what he was doing up there was looking for springs and mapping the faults that localized them. He did a wonderful job.
Aren't there some huge caves up there?
Oh, yeah, big stuff. And we were right on to that. Well, anyway, Jim was a well-known commodity to me by then, and so when we got going on the Grand Canyon map, he was a natural, and what we assigned him, or what he, the part he took on, was to map all the younger Precambrian sedimentary rocks from Marble Canyon all the way down to Shinumu and beyond.
Okay.
So that's what he did, and that's what, that work is really good. It's still good.
Cool. I'm looking at our time here. We've been going about 55 minutes. Would this be a good place to put a comma here in this interview series? And the next time, we would talk about the mapping.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you want to add to the material we've covered here before we wrap it up?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and conclude part 4 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Peter Huntoon. Today is Friday, September 29th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Peter, thank you so very much.
Okay. Now, are you